This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Who are your people? That's a question that's very common as where are you from? But for African Americans, it's not so simple. African American kinship often starts with slavery. Slavery is an institution based on human trafficking that tore families apart. The constant threat of separation from your family was a kind of violence all its own. Historian Heather Williams studied the effort of formerly enslaved people to reconnect with their lost loved ones. It's an effort she considers to be as profound a symbol of hope as slavery is of despair. Heather Williams' new book is called Help Me to Find My People. She joins me now in the studio. Heather, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having me back.
This book came out, in fact, and you got busy on it because of some newspaper ads that you found on, working on another project, right?
Right. I was researching my dissertation some time ago. I was at Yale, and it was on education during slavery. So the book that came out of that is called Self-Taught: African American Education in Slavery and Freedom. And so I was researching in African American newspapers that began publishing shortly after the Civil War. Again, some proof of the literacy of some enslaved people. And I came across these ads that are called, they were labeled Information Wanted. And I was working on this during the summer. By the end of the summer, I found 400 of them. They were short, sometimes 4 lines, 5 lines. The longest might be 10 lines in a newspaper column. And very poignant and powerful. And so an example of one would be Thornton Copeland's ad placed in the Colored Tennessean in 1865 looking for his mother, from whom he had been separated in 1844 in Virginia. And so really powerful because he was still looking for his mother 21 years later. He thought, he hoped that he could find his mother. He only knew her first name. Her first name was Betty. And he even said her name was Betty, which implies that he knew that her name could have changed through sale, through a new owner's whim. And so he named their owners, their traders, hoping that the names of these white men would help people to know his story.
And often it's a list of names. He has to remember 3-4 different owners, and perhaps where they were from and where they went back, where they returned.
Right.
All of that. In a second, I will ask you to read one of those so we can get a sample of the kind of prose. But as I do, and as you find it, I want to ask you if these notices all appeared after the Civil War. Is that right?
Yes. I found 2 notices that appeared before the war. People in Ohio, black people in Ohio, started publishing a newspaper, and I think it only published for about a month or two. But there you saw 2 ads of people looking for family members. So these people had made it to freedom in Ohio and were trying to reunite with their families. But really the outpouring came once the war was over, once people were free. And immediately, so the Civil War ends 1865 in April, and Thornton Copeland's ad, for instance, showed up in the fall of 1865. And I saw them going into the 20th century. They kept looking for family members in this way. But, of course, they also used many other ways of searching for a family.
That's interesting all by itself, that it would go on for 50, 60 years, people still persisting in the hope that they're going to be reconnected.
Yeah, I would say these people were nothing if not persistent. Until 1903, I see people looking for family members, not talking about the memory of somebody, not a trail, not what we do now with genealogy, but they're actually looking for that person to be alive. And of course, the separation would have taken place before 1865. So it's decades later that they're still looking and describing people, naming people, talking about the places where they had last seen them, who had taken them, the circumstances, and again, the names of the traders, the owners, the purchasers, etc.
Do you have one there for us that you can
read?
Well,
I talked about Thornton Copeland, and I will just read the text, the full text of it, which I'd summarized. It was placed in the Colored Tennessean and in Nashville, Tennessee, October 7th, 1865. It says, "Information is wanted of my mother, whom I left in Fauquier County, Virginia, in 1844, and I was sold in Richmond, Virginia, to Samuel Copeland. I formerly belonged to Robert Rogers, I am very anxious to hear from my mother, and any information in relation to her whereabouts will be very thankfully received. My mother's name was Betty and was sold by Colonel Briggs to James French. Any information by letter addressed to the Colored Tennessean, Box 1150, will be thankfully received. Now, in many of the ads, one big source of the ads was the African Methodist Episcopal Church newspaper, the Christian Recorder. And in many of those ads, but in other ads as well, people would say, would ask the preachers of the church, the ministers of the church, to read the ad to their congregations, because this is a way in which the word would get dispersed, so that there might only be one newspaper coming into a particular community. In most communities in the South, there was a Methodist church and a Baptist church, a Black Baptist, Black Methodist. And so if the minister were literate, or if somebody in the congregation were literate in getting this paper, reading it to the congregation would mean reaching possibly hundreds of people who would then leave the session and go out and talk about it. That was the hope of the people placing these ads.
And were you able to determine how effective these ads were?
It's really hard to determine. I mean, my bottom line is that I think very few people found family members. And I have a chapter in the book where I talk about reunification and give examples that I came across. And there's another newspaper, the Southwest Christian Advocate, another religious paper that gave one notice that gave an example of a reunification based on an ad. But I think it happened very rarely. Mm-hmm. People had been so dispersed. As Thornton Copeland said, he was sold in this county in Virginia. I actually went to that county to do research because so many people mentioned it. And there's nothing that I can tell that's really special about it, but it really is emblematic of this domestic slave trade that was taking place in the 1820s, 30s, through to the Civil War, in which Upper South planters were selling people to the Lower South and to the West as the U.S. expanded into Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Texas, for instance. And so many, many people were leaving these places in Virginia.
And of course, as we now know, those in the Deep South, those plantations were really industrial camps. They weren't just, you know, they were not gentlemen farmers so much in the Deep South.
Oh, these are huge plantations.
Huge plantations owned often by absentee landlords who had commodified just about everything.
That's right. And so people are planting cotton, rice, sugar cane in Louisiana, and doing all kinds of work. You see ads, there's several kinds of ads that appear in 19th century newspapers about African Americans. And one of them is people being offered for sale, but also, as you say, industrial railroads wanting to hire 500 black men to work on the railroad, building railroads. So people are being moved all over the landscape. And so this dispersal of people was dramatic. And in the ads, you really see that reflected because people placed ads from all over the South. So people, I'm in Nashville and I'm looking for my mother. I'm in Raleigh and I'm looking for my children. Hagar Outlaw named about 7 children. She was an old woman looking for her children. People from Philadelphia, from New Bedford, Massachusetts, from New York, from Canada, from California, from Detroit, from all over the country looking for family members. And how they had reached those places, it's sometimes really, it's hard for me to know.
Right. and you say that it in fact was the sale and separation of families that is how especially young people came to understand their condition of enslavement.
Yes, I found that over and over again. And I begin the book with a chapter on the separation of children. So people who as adults wrote narratives of their lives and talked about what it was like being separated from their parents as children. And they said often, you know, they were young children, 6, 7, 8. They did not realize that they were slaves. They were just children. They played in the yard, sometimes with the owner's children. They did some little odd jobs, but they did not realize what their status was until the owner died, or the owner was gravely ill, or an owner was in serious debt. And then the adults in the community of slaves started being anxious about what would happen to them, because an owner's death, the adults knew, meant that the people, his property, his real estate and his human property might be divided up among his heirs or might be sold. And so there was this increased anxiety among the parents, and the children start to realize. And sometimes they would, some people talked about a white man coming onto the farm or onto the plantation and leaving with one of the children's playmates. A young boy goes off. And so they start to hide when they see a strange white man. And so they're coming to this slow realization that they were slaves, and that being slaves meant that they could be sold and separated from their parents. And also something that I found really powerful was that they would turn to their parents, often to their mothers, for some consolation, for some comfort. And the mother saying, I can't do anything about this. And then they see their mothers just crying, weeping at the moment of sale. And even then, sometimes the children did not quite comprehend what was happening. And it took them time to really understand that this man who was taking taking them away from the mother was taking them away for good, and that they would never see that mother again. And so there is this kind of moment later on in African American history. You'll see people like W.B. Du Bois say, there's this moment when I realized I was black. And in the earlier time period, it's a moment when they realized they were slaves.
And you have a section in the book that talks about the impact on the whole community when there was going to be a sale or an auction.
Yes. I'll read this short section. It's in the chapter that's called Blue Glass Beads Tied in a Rag of Cotton Cloth, The Search for Family During Slavery. Oh, fare ye well, oh, fare ye well. God bless you until we meet again. Hope to meet you in heaven to part no more. Peter Randolph heard other slaves sing at moments of sale and separation. Jacob Stroyer recalls slaves singing a similar song when his sisters were sold to a trader who planned to take them and others from Columbia, South Carolina to Louisiana. The victims were to take the cars from a station called Clarkson Turnout, which was about 4 miles from Master's Place, Stroyer recalled. The excitement was so great that the overseer and driver could not control the relatives and friends of those that were going away, as a large crowd of both old and young went down to the depot to see them off. According to Stroyer, Louisiana, quote, was considered by the slaves as a place of slaughter, so those who were going did not expect to see their friends again, end quote. As the friends and relatives walked to the train station to say goodbye, Stroyer said, many of the Negroes left their master's field and joined us as we marched to the cars. Some were yelling and wringing their hands, while others were singing little hymns that they were accustomed to for the consolation of those that were going away, such as, when we all meet in heaven, there is no parting there. When we all meet in heaven, there is no parting no more.
Heather Williams reading from her new book, Help Me to Find My People, The African-American Search for Family Lost in Slavery. And that opens up this whole idea of separation being a kind of death, seen as death.
Yes, and I think many enslaved people talked about separation as death. And in this chapter, I really tease out some contradictions or some conflicting ways of dealing with it. But It was so final, but in other ways it wasn't. Because they kept hoping that it wasn't. I talk about Thomas Jefferson, who of course was a slave owner, and while he was president, wrote a letter back to his plantation in Virginia, giving orders for a particular man to be sold to the Deep South if he were not convicted. So Jefferson had this nail factory, had enslaved men and boys who were producing nails that he sold. One of those men killed or seriously hurt another of the men whom he owned. And so Jefferson was saying in this letter, if the courts don't do away with him, then I want you to sell him to Georgia, because to the slaves, Georgia is like being dead. And that message will be that he's dead. He's gone. And so the owners realized that. The enslaved people thought of it that way. At the same time, I talk about this term that some psychologists use of ambiguous loss. which I found really intriguing and very helpful. And, you know, we think about if there's a plane crash and the bodies are never recovered, there's some family member who will forever think that her child somehow crawled away from that plane alive, that her husband made it out, that his wife, you know, so there's this ambiguous loss because there's no body. And with separation, that's what happened. People were taken away. They're led away, presumably to be sold, but you don't know where they're going. You don't know if they make it to where they're going. You don't know if they die on the way. After 10 years, you don't know if they're still alive. And so people are living with these what I would call conflicting feelings, because on the one hand, separation is like death, but you didn't bury anybody. Mm. You did not put a body away. And so then you're holding on to this hope. And some of those people are then writing these ads or writing to the Freedmen's Bureau or traveling miles to get back to North Carolina to find a family member. And maybe when they get there, they realize, oh, my father is dead and my mother is just, you know, she's just not the person she was anymore.
You know, it's interesting because this inevitability of separation didn't lead to any kind of diminution of the idea or devotion to family. The concept of marriage, which wasn't recognized as legal among the owners, seemed to be very important.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that I always have to say that I can never know what every African American thought at any moment. So, of course, there may be some people who said, family, forget it. But what I show in here is just lots of evidence of people continuing to care about family members and going on even after separation and continuing to form bonds and perhaps remarrying. And so when you get to reunification after the war, you get some problems there because now you've married somebody else, but your first husband has come back looking for you. What are you going to do? What choice are you going to make? And so I see people, I think that the evidence in this book clearly demonstrates that many, many, I would even say most African Americans continued to care deeply about family. They entered into relationships that they called marriages and that they considered marriages, even though they could not legally marry. They could not legally marry because they were property. Property cannot enter into contracts, and that's what marriage is. It's a legal contract, which would have created all kinds of problems for owners. And one of the chapter in which I talk about marriage is called Put Asunder, because many enslaved people and former slaves said they never said in our marriage ceremonies, let no man put us under, like they did for the white people, because it was always understood that it was the owner's prerogative to separate people when he needed to, when he wanted to, when that was in his best economic interest. Yet they kept, and I start that chapter with some men talking about the conflicts. And Henry Bibb says, you know, I never wanted to get married because I knew that would tie me to the plantation. Then he meets this woman, Melinda. He falls in love with her. He describes her as just being beautiful and articulate and talented. And that he enters into an agreement with her that she would try to escape with him. So they get married. And I mean, that's a very long, awful story. But they entered into these relationships. They had these bonds. They turned to marriage often as a way of consoling themselves after they had lost members of their nuclear family.
Heather, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Heather Andrea Williams is a professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill, the author of the new book, Help Me to Find My People. Coming up after a short break, three NC State students create a short film that makes its way from Durham to Cannes. Stay with us on The State of Things.